my name is Bob Bamber and welcome to the Wrestling 20 Years Ago podcast. We're going back in the time machine to August of 1994. I'm being joined by Colin Judkins.
Hello.
And Chris Lazy.
Evening.
Colin, the news.
Okay, Hulk Hogan and Ric Flair have set some records. The Clash of the Champions broke a number of wrestling-related viewing records in the main event where Flair defeated Hogan by count-out. The show was most widely watched pro wrestling match ever on cable television, being seen in over 4 million homes and was the largest audience for any NWA-WCW match in modern history. Ric Flair was the official winner of the match thanks to Hulk Hogan being counted out whilst hanging out of the ring locked in the figure four. The story of the entire show, though, was Hogan facing a race against time to get back to the arena after being attacked by a masked villain in the first half an hour with a what looked like lead pipe to the knee. In the storyline since, Ric Flair and Sherry Martel have been suspended indefinitely in the United States by WCW Commissioner Nick Bockwinkel.
Shane Douglas wins the NWA World title, then throws it onto the floor. Shane Douglas won the NWA World Heavyweight title in the tournament final at an ECW event recently, but would cause massive waves when the legends that previously held the title would kiss his ass and threw the title down. The plan, which was weeks in the making, was unbeknownst to NWA board member Dennis Corozzo, and the event was described as a double cross with only a handful of names, Douglas, Paul Heyman and Todd Gordon, amongst them knowing what the plan was. The event marks a sharp turn in the company's short history. Not surprisingly, the company has now dropped NWA's name and from now on will be known as Extreme Championship Wrestling.
Okay, WWF SummerSlam was dominated perhaps by the best and the worst the company has to offer in the space of the final hour. Bret Hart retained his title in a cage match against his brother Owen, which was rated as 5 stars by Dave Meltzer, but the match was likely overshadowed by one of the worst main events in WWF history, as the returning Undertaker defeated the fake Undertaker in front of a near-silent crowd, which Vince McMahon attempted to cover up by saying that they were in awe of the two Undertakers. Post-match angles did dominate the show. Tatanka turned on Lex Luger joining the Million Dollar Man, Ted DiBiase, and Jim the Anvil, Neidhart with Owen Hart locked Bret Hart back in the cage after the title match and beat the champion down while the other members of the Hart family, including the British Bulldog, watched on and tried to stop it.
Clash of the Champions. Along with Hogan retaining his title, the Clash of the Champions saw Ricky the Dragon Steamboat defeat Stunning Steve Austin to win the United States Championship, and a major angle in the conclusion of the tag team match between Dustin and Dusty Rhodes and the team of Terry Funk and Bunkhouse Buck. The match itself ended in disqualification when Arn Anderson got involved, but the post-match beatdown initially saw Dusty clean house with his trademark bionic elbow before smashing Ming over the head with a chair. Ming stood his ground, no-selling the chair, put the claw on Dusty's shoulder, while several jobbers were beaten down by the stud stable.
It's no question about it, Two Cold Scorpio, you are one hell of a competitor, and I will not be a champion at Hides. I stand here before God and my Father in heaven tonight, as I said I would be world heavyweight champion. In the tradition of Lou Ness, in the tradition of Jack Briscoe, of the Briscoe brothers, of Dory Funk Jr., of Terry Funk, the man who'll never die. As the real nature boy, Buddy Rogers upstairs tonight. From the Harley races to the Barry Windham Cruda. Ric Flair's. I accept this heavyweight title. Wait a second. Wait a second. Oh, Terry Von Erich.
of the Fat Man himself, Dusty Rhodes. This is it tonight, Dad. God, that's beautiful. And Rick Steamboat. And they can all kiss my ass.
What in the hell is he doing?
Because I am not the man who accepts a torch to be handed down to me from an organization that died, R.I.P., 7 years ago. The franchise, Shane Douglas, is the man who ignites the new flame of the sport of professional wrestling.
That's the ECW
tonight,
belt.
Before God and my father as witness, I declare myself, the franchise, as the new ECW heavyweight champion of the world.
Shane Douglas declaring himself,
we have set out
ECW
to change
world
the
champion
of professional wrestling. So tonight, let the new era begin. The era of the sport of professional wrestling. The era of the franchise.
Taking a break from WWF and WCW action, we are filling in with the kind of 8 to 10 weeks of ECW that we've missed since the end of June. Obviously, last month we had the steroid trial, which kind of meant that any time I would have had to watch it would have been away. So, Colin and Chris have left us, and I'm being joined by Del Muir. Del, good afternoon.
Hi, Bob.
And we are going to review a massive, I was going to say massive 2 months of ECW, but a massive, like, 5 days that have just concluded. We'll start with the news, as we covered at the top of the show, that Shane Douglas won the NWA World Heavyweight Championship and then threw it down after defeating Too Cold Scorpio in the final of the NWA title tournament that also included Chris Benoit, 9-1-1, Doink the Clown, portrayed by Matt Bourne, Dean Malenko, Osamu Nishimura, and the Tasmaniac. After the match, Douglas cut a promo that you've just heard, denouncing himself as the NWA World Heavyweight Champion, throwing down the title belt and proclaiming himself the champion of what is now, quote, Extreme Championship Wrestling. The tournament was NWA approved to happen in its entirety by the NWA board, and while it was assumed initially that Benoit would be winning the title, the plan in the days leading up to it was absolutely that Douglas would win the NWA Heavyweight title, as he is currently still recognised, we believe. What happened since the bell rang is said to be one of the most public double crosses in an industry full of them, and an unsizable blow to the declining legacy of the NWA World Heavyweight title. The company as we knew it, NWA Eastern Championship Wrestling, has been quote-unquote folded, and in its place is ECW, Extreme Championship Wrestling, dropping both the NWA link and the Eastern part of their name, which is believed because they wanted to get rid of isolation issues. Del, just talk me through your thoughts of this. I mean, a lot of this has aired on the latest episode of ECW Hardcore TV on the 30th of August. But your thoughts on this, both in terms of how it played on TV and just the event as a whole?
It's going to be big stuff, I think, Bob, especially looking at potential ramifications for this going forward. It's in the industry, as you say, it's not the first time, obviously, there's been kind of smoke and mirrors. It's not the first time that there's been double turns, but to do it on national TV, to do it with the attendance of one of the board members of the NWA.
Not on national TV, regional, should be said.
Well, on regional TV, sorry. It's gonna be big. It's gonna be big in the coming weeks and months, I think, how they go with this. Shane Douglas is billed as the franchise, and if you go back and look at some of the episodes for August, especially the promo after the tournament, you can see why they're building that round him. What it means for the NWA, it's a bit embarrassing. Obviously going back to 91, looking at the Flair situation where they dropped the ball with him having the belt, they were trying to kind of get away from that legacy, and it was looking good up until the end, and it's just all went kind of balls up again for them. So
it feels like the NWA has been like turned down by the ugly girl at school.
Kinda.
It's one thing to get dropped by WCW, a nationwide and international company with a lot of money and attendances in the thousands and, you know, big production values and all that, and Hulk Hogan on their roster now. It's quite another to go to a regional promotion that's less than 2 years old that gets,
a wee regional,
you know,
territory, lucky to draw, yeah, a house over three figures. It's, yep.
Yeah, and then for them to go, nah, you know what, even for us, this brand isn't worth anything anymore. It's hard to imagine any way back from this unless, I don't know. I don't know for the NWA, but I mean, focusing on the ECW part, I mean, the tournament by all accounts was excellent, and we saw the final match on ECW Hardcore TV with Shane Douglas and Too Cold Scorpio. That was actually quite a good match as well.
It was.
And your thoughts on just kind of that Douglas promo afterwards? I mean, you know, referencing all the big names and then saying, you know, they can kiss my ass and all of that. What do you think of that promo?
That's it. And I mean, even going back to the Gotchies and the Thesies, I mean, he wasn't messing about with that.
Seemed to be taking requests from the audience during that promo as well.
Pretty much. And then even at the end, I mean, he's got them, they believe in Douglas, they believe in this new ECW. And I mean, for them, contrary to what we've said about the NWA and how they're going to bounce back for this, ECW, the sky's the limit, I think, from now on. At the end, you've got them chanting Flair is dead, which is pretty frightening stuff when you're looking at what used to be seen as a regional territory that's kind of floundering along, as you say. They're only on regional TV. They are the ugly girl at the dance here compared to the competition that they've got. I don't see them holding back on this. I think they're just going to strap the rocket to this promotion and see where it goes.
No, I mean, it will be interesting to see. I mean, to pick up one of your points earlier about this kind of being like major news, it was interesting that Dennis Coluzzo, who's a member of the NWA board and who was at the arena for the taping and was very much not in the loop for this, it should be said. And I believe earlier in the night, I don't think this will air, it certainly didn't, they had him and Todd Gordon in the ring talking about the NWA title, mm-hmm, and its legacy. What I thought was interesting was, I think you said earlier that this was kind of going to make like massive news, and Coluzzo, maybe just in hope more than anything, kind of said, well, how many people are really going to know about this beyond the people in attendance and the people that read like the Wrestling Observer and the Torch? Which I guess is fair enough. And you wouldn't have thought have made kind of national waves, but that probably says more about just the low level of the legacy of the NWA World Heavyweight title now, given, mm-hmm, that it's, yeah, I've been following pretty closely this past 12 months since it got dropped by WCW, and it's very easy to miss the news about the NWA title. It's certainly not, doesn't seem to be all that relevant anymore.
Well, that's it. Looking at the last few years, it's just been, it's pretty much a paper organisation these days. And I mean, that's,
well, it's a territory world title for an industry without many territories and with world titles that now mean a lot more.
Exactly. And I mean, you've got to look at it from ECW's point of view, but I think they're seeing the bigger picture. And I think the NWA is just trying to focus on trying to kind of get a bit of, kind of trying to redevelop a legacy, I think, more than anything else. And it kind of looks as if they've just been left behind again.
What do you think about Extreme Championship Wrestling?
It's exciting. I think, I mean, there are a lot of superlatives you could probably use for that, you know. It is exciting, it is extreme looking back at the, I mean, as long as you want to go back really on, it's called Hardcore Television for a start. You're getting the likes of Cactus and Terry Funk that's coming into the promotion. You're seeing
Sabu,
some of the stuff that they're doing,
Sabu. Around.
Even looking back to what we were discussing last month, we've seen Cactus on WCW, it's as if they've had that conversation with him to try and hold back. You tune in to ECW, you will not see anybody from opening match to main event, you will not see anybody holding back anything. and you can see why it's building up that cult following at the minute, where they are seeing a true alternative. You're not going to see as much cartoons as you would maybe see in New York. You're not going to see as much kind of 80s wrestlers try to hold on to the respect to the old kind of wrestling style that you'll see down south. This is a true alternative for people.
Yeah, and there is certainly a very big thing that Eastern Championship Wrestling did sound very regional and very old school, and that's exactly the attitude they didn't want. As to whether Extreme Championship Wrestling kind of gives off the wrong connotations or sounds like a little bit lame, I guess the only way to find out about that will be just by time will tell, really.
Following it, yeah.
But, you know, I think getting rid of the NWA moniker and calling yourself Extreme, it is a big marker, but it is, I think, one that they absolutely wanted to make, and they absolutely want to kind of modernize the name and the brand. So it is a bit more, you know, counterculture and all that, and more. And I guess we'll see how that goes. Moving on to that NWA thing, all kind of featured in the 30th of August edition of ECW Hardcore TV. So if you have access to that, do watch it. The other half of that show is what we're going to move on to now, which perhaps I think if the Douglas NWA title bit second half of the show was the most noteworthy thing, perhaps the most powerful thing we've seen in the relatively short history of ECW TV was Tommy Dreamer taking 10 whips of the Singapore Cane. He had a match with Sandman where the loser was stipulated would take the punishment of being struck 10 times with the quote-unquote Singapore Cane. It's just an ordinary cane, but add Singapore to it to make it newsworthy. A move which was seen as a way to toughen up the Dreamer character, who has been booed at times of being a quote-unquote pretty boy. He was actually offered the chance of restarting a match after defeat came very much from interference from Sandman's manager, or valet, Woman. He turned down this reprieve from Todd Gordon, along with multiple calls from Woman that he could stop the punishment if he simply got down on his knees and kissed her feet. At one stage, when refusing, he grabbed the microphone and said, "Thank you, sir, may I have another?" Instead, he would receive 10 cane strikes to the back, each more brutal than the last. Dreamer's back was covered in blood and welts at the end. Del, this was an incredible segment in so many ways.
This was incredible. This was powerful, as you say. This was, at times, frightening to watch as well.
Because those hurt. There's no... I believe there are ways you can modify those types of weapons so they don't hurt like quite as badly as you might think, but those hurt.
Yep, there's no getting away for that. And I mean, even the camera sticking with it as well, there was visible kind of welts really on the back of Dreamer. I mean, blood was pouring. I mean, what were we just saying 2 minutes ago about Extreme? This could possibly be the level of, I don't even know what you would call it, that we're likely going to be seeing with ECW going forward.
If that's the bar and they top that, good luck.
That's the worrying thing, obviously. I think this actually aired, was it on the 30th of August show, this one?
Yeah, this was the precursor to the Douglas thing. I mean, in many ways, just easily the most significant episode of ECW TV ever.
You're seeing this as well before they even announce the name change to Extreme as well. So, I mean, if this is something that they're going to be trying to top on a week-to-week basis, then God help us for watching it. But as you say, I mean, it's just powerful stuff. I mean, you're seeing two guys in the ring. Sandman, we're not going to kind of try and pull the wool over anybody's eyes here. Sandman is not a pretty man. Sandman is not a well-defined, as in physically, man. He's not even a good wrestler, but he's a captivating character. He's easily one of the, if you kind of tune in and watch an hour of each promotion, you're going to remember the Sandman, whether it's coming out to Metallica, if it's coming out with a cigarette hanging out his mouth. There was even, kind of looking back to the buy-in that these talents have got for the promotion and the direction that they're going in, there's a promo mid-August, I think it was, in the build-up to this, where Sandman actually opens his cell up hard way with a cane during a promo. It's not even kind of mid-match or anything. Like, he's backstage talking with women, and he cuts his cell with a cane, battering it off his own head. If ever you are looking for a buy-in for people and the kind of type of powerful stuff that you're likely going to see, these two just... it's absolutely captivating stuff, as you say.
No, completely. I think what is quite significant almost is that this is an audience that wants to be smart. This is an audience that wants to kind of, almost cheer the bad guys. Like 911 is a heel, but he gets cheered because he's 911. And yet, maybe at the start of the Dreamer thing, like they were kind of, all right, this is just part of the story. But I think there was a very real turn, a very real kind of tangible change in the crowd during that segment where they went, this is a bit different from what we're used to.
Well, that's it with the 10 shots as well. I mean, it starts off 1 and 2. Yes, yes, hit him, pretty boy, get him done, show him what he's worth. And then as that got on, by every Kane shot, you could see visible shock in that crowd, and they knew they were witnessing something that's going to be a game changer here.
What do you think of woman's role, both in that segment and just as a sidekick to Sandman? I think she's playing a perfect foil for
it. I think so, yeah. I mean, looking back to what we've seen before, where brief run in ECW with the likes of Sherry Martel, it's a spot that's got a place in this company. And I mean, woman does carry it off perfect. I mean, it's been for me one of the most fascinating things about the product in this month. I mean, you'll see them backstage with Sandman and woman, and their relationship and their on-screen conversations between each other. It's just a captivating thing, and the way that that's brought into feuds. You've got Tommy Dreamer kind of trying to get into the head of the woman with kissing her in the ring when she's kind of trying to hit him with a cane and things like that. You see the kind of relationship with, as I say, Sandman and woman is really, really interesting. And having that as a backdrop to something that's so visibly captivating, and having that kind of psychology backstage and kind of what is going to happen with A2, is it a case where we're going to see women go with Dreamer down the line, or it's just a really, really interesting thing, and I think she plays her part perfect.
Hello, ECW. It's your friend Cactus Jack bringing you tidings from World Championship Wrestling. What this belt here says is that Cactus Jack is one half of the best tag team champion in the world. And it means a lot to me because people say it's the first belt, it's the first title that Cactus Jack has had in a long time, and indeed it is very dear to me. Not anymore! Not anymore. You might think it's nice for Cactus Jack to come in, give one of the performances of his life, lose, and walk away saying I still got a title. But it's not true. Bang, bang. Because tonight, I lost the 3 titles that I'd held for the past 5 years. Most suicidal wrestler, ugliest wrestler, and Jack Kevorkian's favorite wrestler. So there's 1 of 3 paths that Cactus Jack can choose. 1, concede the title. Never forget! 2, outdo Sabu, but looking at my battered body, it's not physically possible. And there's a 3rd path, the road less traveled, that Cactus Jack must set his smelly feet upon. And that is simply to eliminate the competition. Eliminate the competition. Eliminate the competition. Sabu, I got nothing against you, except that you're this much better than me, but not anymore. How will you fly when you don't have a foot? How will you speak when you don't have a tongue? And how will you hear when you're not just missing half the ear, but the whole ball of wax? Bully dangerously, you hurt my feelings, because when you were looking for the most gifted man to bring down WCW, you didn't call me. You got a phone because I felt it 3 times, but you didn't call me. I'm sick and tired of being a family entertainer. There's such a thing as a contract in Atlanta where I come from, but it don't mean nothing to me, because one way or another, I said it before and I said it again, Mrs. Foley's little boy is coming home. Bang, bang!
Del, let's look back at the, first is the Cactus Jack promo we just heard, and going back a full, more than 2 months to June the 24th, the Hostile City Showdown, I was going to say pay-per-view, that's not right, the the kind of special, the live event essentially that you can get on video. We didn't get it, we didn't get the video until July, and then also there was no time to review it. But specifically looking at this Cactus Jack Sabu match and the pair of promos, and we heard the Cactus Jack one. I didn't play the Paulie Dangerously one just because it would have made the segment longer, even that it will be anyway. But, you know, Cactus Jack throwing down the then, his then WCW tag team title belt. He's since been stripped of it, and the apparently WCW were not happy with him throwing that down at all, though.
Yeah.
I think they should have just got over it. But what, firstly, we'll start with the match, I think, before we get to the promos. What did you think of this Cactus Jack Sabu match?
Even just going back to the absolute start, Bob, it's one of the lost arts in wrestling these days that you'll maybe only see rivaled by The Undertaker. It's even just something as simple as an entrance. Sabu feels like a big deal. Sabu feels like it's something you've never seen before. Coming in the gurney, coming in with 911 and Paulie, as soon as he gets released for that gurney, you feel, what the hell am I going to see here?
Even the small things, as you say, once he got in the ring, like 911 held him in the corner while Cactus Jack came out and while the reintroductions happened.
Exactly.
And then 911 just let him go and unleashed him.
And that's it. As I say, it's you always feel with either one of these two that you don't quite know what you're going to see. And when you get them in the same ring, it's just marvellous to behold.
No, I completely agree. I mean, the match was, it kind of spilled to the outside on numerous occasions. There was multiple tables used at one point. There was, I think they were broadly on the outside, and obviously 911's out there, so it's effectively a handicap match for most of it anyway. Cactus Jack gets laid, 911 and Sabu open up the guardrails so that he can put the table kind of beyond where in theory seats should be, although people have kind of scattered. Lays Cactus Jack on the table, then does a springboard moonsault from the apron ropes to the outside through a table. That was great. Brought back in the ring and everywhere else, there were chairs involved, Paulie Dangerously got involved, all of the above. Little bit of a soft finish, but I think it was more, they want to do this match again. I think, Paulie Dangerously hit, Cactus Jack over the head with his phone.
We
haven't seen actually all that much, I don't think. Sabu pinned him for the three. Then after the match was a further brawl, and there was a great bit where Cactus Jack and 911 are on the outside, and Sabu sets up a chair, kind of level with the middle of the ring by one of the sides where they're brawling, unfolds it, bounces off the far rope, does a running plancha off the chair, over the rope, to the outside. Amazing. Amazing spot that right after the match. But a really, really good match, and one of those matches where I just think, if I was in the building, yes, I want to come see this again.
Like, it's exactly.
Very difficult not to go that and not think, I've definitely got to be at the next show.
Exactly. It's an event.
Yes, exactly. And then that promo, Del.
Aye. It's, you kind of feel like when you're watching hardcore TV that you're going to see something getting unleashed. And when you see someone that's got the mind of Cactus Jack, I mean, there was some of these throughout the month. Even I sat down and interview with Terry Funk. He's so intriguing. And you genuinely don't know what's going on in his head. And then when you give him a live mic and some of the stuff that comes out, you just kind of take your eyes away from it.
It's very difficult to watch this and wonder why WCW aren't doing more with him. I think they're about to turn him heel, which I think is a mistake, or in fact they have now. And you know, he was in that run kind of mid last year with Vader and having some great matches and some really good promos. And as much as I've enjoyed his tag team work with the Nasty Boys and with guys like Max Payne and Kevin Sullivan in the last 6 months, it's amazing that they've not set him up for Hogan. Not that he'd beat Hogan, but I don't know why they're not priming him for that match, because that could be, all right, I guess they're both faces, but maybe they're turning heels to do just that. But I don't know why they're not priming him for that spot, because I think that'd be something really different and really good. And you watch all of this and you're just like, he's got talent. He is unique in so many ways, and yet I feel like a company like WCW could find a big spot for him.
I totally agree. I think he just needs more, give him more time, let him develop. The on-air development that he's going through, even just in the short time that you see him in ECW as well, he's just something completely different, which can never be a bad thing for me.
I want to take a quick minute to talk about Sabu, because we haven't seen a ton of his matches on ECW Hardcore TV, and through time constraints and through just not a, like having a big event, we haven't really spoken about Sabu in this last 6 months. But I do want to underline just how good Sabu is.
He's absolutely unique. As you see, that spot with the chair and then doing the diving springboard to the outside off the top rope, you're not going to see that anywhere else, Bob.
No. Certainly not with all the changes in both major national companies, where it's almost, to come back to the thing about the name change earlier, it's almost perfect timing in the sense that it seems to be in both companies in the last 2 months, they both said either by choice or more just by like kind of happenstance or just by order that they're going to have to rein in their own in-ring style.
Yeah.
And this is kind of like the more those forks in the road kind of diverge, the more unique ECW will become, and the more that I think people might gravitate to this style. I mean, we had, I think, was it the Clash of the Champions in June, where we had the Nasty Boys Cactus Jack Kevin Sullivan match, where it was okay, it was free TV, so you maybe wouldn't have ordered the walking brawl that we saw at something like Spring Stampede.
Mm-hmm.
But that was them almost in the constraints of, because you could have given a little taste of what they were doing, but they couldn't.
That's it. I mean, it almost even seemed like backwards booking at the time as well, where we'd seen the two brawls with those four guys in the ring, and then almost as a climax, it goes back to a straight up in the ring tag match.
And between almost four guys that just aren't remotely suited to that kind of
exactly. And I mean, it's an overused saying, but with this ECW situation and the name change and Cactus being there, Sabu, it's almost as if the stars are literally aligning for them. Especially with what's happening with the two national promotions as well. This could really be something where they can fill that gap in the market.
No, and we go back to WWF Raw in June or July, that segment with Joe the King Lawler and Duke the Drumster Druzy with the thing with the trash can, and they had to, because they were live, so they couldn't edit it, and they had to quickly pan out. They didn't mention it for the rest of the show, and then the following week, Jerry Lawler gave a, in kayfabe, very forced apology. And it's quite difficult watching that, particularly as it's not, you know, you can understand the apology if it came for something like quite brutal, but it was actually something fairly kind of placid, really.
Pretty mild, yeah.
And all of that, but just, again, one of those things where I'm looking forward to where all this is going with ECW. This 30th of August edition of this show is, I would say, must watch. Above any episode of Raw, any episode of WCW Saturday Night, any episode of anything we've seen, I would say that hour is the most significant 1 hour non-pay-per-view that I've watched this year. And Dale, to fill in all the gaps, you've got the TV and kind of live event recap for us for covering kind of the last 10 weeks.
Yeah, another couple of things that happened. A further look at the Sudden Rise of Extreme, saw that Perry Mick Foley and longtime friend Terry Funk caused major concerns at a recent live event. At the end of the match, both participants evoked a pretty riotous atmosphere when they actually asked the crowd to throw their own chairs into the ring. It actually forced the premature end of the show.
Just to butt in, having seen this segment recently, we're not talking a few chairs.
No.
We're talking 60...
at least four or five rows deep. And everybody folding up metal chairs that you will see swung in a ring maybe once or twice a month, thrown into the ring. And visually, it's up there with Tommy Dreamer and Sandman for me for a visual, Bob. It's something to behold.
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, there's, you can see people around ringside scarpering, and whoever they were, I think the Public Enemy legged it as well, because they were interfering in that match.
Yep.
And I think Terry Funk just says, throw me a chair. And so one comes in, then another comes in, then a third, and then he's in the middle of the ring. Cactus Jack is in the corner. Cactus Jack realizes, I can't get out of here. Funk just kind of like lays flat on the floor, like, I can't go anywhere. And it's just a deluge of chairs. And one thing we found out is that your average ECW attendee has an above average throwing arm. It was
pretty impressive. I mean, it's just, again, come back to what we spoke about earlier, Bob. it's that buy-in for the crowd that just makes this a really, really exciting time, I think, for this company. Getting away for the NWA Eastern tags that kind of gives it a bit of a kind of carny feel, a bit of a localised feel. Seeing stuff like this that, how often these days, mid-90s, can we say you've never seen this before? And we've seen it at least twice just in what we've briefly discussed here.
See it twice in about 45 minutes of one TV show.
In one show, aye.
Yeah. No, very good. Oh, carry on with your TV review.
Just lastly, Jason, that you might be aware of if you've been watching the show, Jason Stables rapidly expanding. There was a second Pitbull revealed this month, and also a Chad Hostin heel turn. Bad Chad actually laid down for the Rock and Rebel during the match to join Jason and his stable, taking his numbers to 4. Jason's also actually returned to the ring as well, making 5 active competitors altogether. With the help of the group, Jason actually won the TV title from underdog Mickey Whipwreck at Hardcore Heaven recently. And Whipwreck himself has moved on to team with Cactus Jack and get the tag titles off the Public Enemy. The title change is still to appear on TV, but Whipwreck actually replaced Terry Funk, who wasn't at the event.
And that will end that part of the segment. Del, thank you very much for joining me this afternoon.
Not at all, pleasure, Bob.
You are on Twitter.
I am, just Del_Muir, DEL_MUIR on Twitter.
I'm going in this match with one thing in mind. First of all, this World Wrestling Federation Championship belt isn't going anywhere. It's going right back over my shoulder, back in the dressing room, because I'm going to prove that I am better than Owen. I was always better than Owen. You know, Owen, I want you to understand something. I don't hate you. I don't hate your guts. I never, ever did. I've never got into this thing thinking or believing that I hated your guts, because I don't. The problem with you is you. It's in your head. It's in your heart. Jealousy is a horrible thing. It's an ugly thing that's, you know, Neidhart, now that might be a different story. Maybe I might just go that far and say I hate his guts, because I believe right inside my heart that it was Jim Neidhart right from the start that started all this stuff. He's the one that planted the seeds of jealousy in Owen in the first place. Owen, I don't hate you. I just kind of feel sorry for you. And in this match, brother against brother, Cain and Abel, whatever you want to call it, it breaks my heart to think that it's come this far, that two brothers are going to be in the most, this is barbaric. This has nothing to do with what we grew up with, believing in wrestling, exchanging holds and all. This has gone way beyond that. This is out of the dungeon now. This is a dogfight. This is something, this is like caged animals, and it's something that I'm not very proud of. But the fact is, it has to stop. You know, people don't understand when I got my mother come up to me with tears in her eyes and beg me to see this thing end. My father wants to see it end. Everybody wants to see it end. And I've tried to end it. I've tried to find some place to stop it. And there's no place you can end it. But now I see this is it. It's going to be an ugly fight. It's going to be a dog fight. And there's going to be one winner and one loser. And I'm not going to lose this thing, Owen. I'm going in there with every single thing I got. And I'm going to beat you, brother. And I just hope, after it's all said and done, that you can live with it.
Thanks very much to Del for that. We're back now with Colin and Chris, and we are looking at WWF SummerSlam. Colin, if you could start by telling us the results.
Okay, in the opener, IRS and Bam Bam Bigelow defeated the Head Shrinkers by disqualification. Alundra Blaze defeated Bull Nakano in a match for the WWF Women's Championship. Razor Ramon with Walter Payton defeated Diesel with Shawn Michaels for the Intercontinental Championship, new champion. Tatanka defeated Lex Luger. Jeff Jarrett defeated Mabel. Bret Hart defended the WWF Championship against Owen Hart in a steel cage match. And in the main event, The Undertaker defeated the fake Undertaker.
Chris, what were your thoughts on this show?
It was very much a tale of two halves. When it was good, it was very, very good. But when it was bad, it was goddamn ugly. The Taker-Taker match, other than the entrance at the very beginning, was a waste of 20 minutes. The opener was terrible. Lex and Tatanka was terrible. But when it was great, the Bret and Owen cage match is probably my match of the year so far.
Colin?
Yeah. You could probably split the card in two thirds, maybe. You give Bret Hart and Owen Hart and I think Razor Ramon and Diesel matches of the night, and then the rest of the card was not fantastic. I mean, the opener, which was supposed to be a tag team title match, ended up...
I should add that the Headshrinkers are no longer tag team champions. We got to the show and Sean and Diesel were tag champions.
Yeah, and we're just given a
live event.
Just given the explanation right at the very start of the show. So basically it became a meaningless tag team match. Alundra Blaze and Bull Nakano. I mean, the crowd seemed to really like Alundra Blaze. So I personally just can't seem to get, I can't get into these women matches. They don't really interest me at all. But Alundra Blaze seems to be crazily over with the fans. So I can understand why it was on the card. Tatanka, Lex Luger. I mean, for what it was okay. I mean, for Tatanka matches, you mainly get a bit of skipping around the ring and some chops from the top rope and standing in front of his opponents about all he does. But I think we could see the turn. I personally saw the turn coming a mile off. I never understand why Mabel's on the card. Guy's beyond awful. Jeff Jarrett's better than Mabel.
I've somehow forgotten about that match.
Yeah,
you read through your reviews, and I thought this is a good show up until the main event, and then you reminded me of that. Yeah, there's that as well. Carry on.
Thankfully, Jeff Jarrett went over. I mean, if Mabel had gone over Jarrett, it could have been a nail in the coffin for Jarrett personally.
It's hard to throw in the towel, really.
Yeah, but yeah, then you get to the WWF Championship match. I mean, I'm a sticker for tradition. I would have preferred the WWF title match to be the main event. But I understand why the Undertaker match was there. You know, they'd built it for so long and they'd invested quite a lot of time and money into it. I mean, having Leslie Nielsen do his silly sketches, looking for the Undertaker. I feel a bit sorry for Bret and Owen because it was a fantastic steel cage match. I really enjoyed it and I enjoyed what went on afterwards as well. But then of course you get to the Undertaker match and it was just,
I think we'll come to it. I think. Long story short. Yeah. No. I mean, I had kind of wiped the Jeff Jarrett Mabel match from my mind, but it wasn't all that long. But up until like the end of the title match, the Bret Owen match, I thought this was a really good show. You know, the wrestling wasn't great, but it wasn't bad. The cage match was excellent for a cage match, although I don't quite think it was as good as some people are necessarily making it out. And plus, I think it was a tad long. And then we got this main event. We'll come to that in time. Let's start with the opener. We started with the show, really. Jerry Lawler and Vince McMahon running down the show. Usual stuff here, but they didn't know that the British Bulldog was in the building. We would see him later on. We started with what, as he said, is now a non-tag title match as the Headshrinkers lost the titles to Shawn Michaels and Diesel a couple of nights before at a live event. So we have the Headshrinkers versus Bam Bam Bigelow and IRS representing Ted DiBiase. The Headshrinkers came out wearing some amazing headwear. In my notes I've got here, it was like a papal hat bordered in fur and shiny things. Bam Bam Fatu exchanged some big looking kicks, but Bam Bam lost the advantage when he missed the top rope splash. Samu goes for a flying crossbody, but misses, quote, quite elegantly, that's quoting myself there. A massive mid-ring collision between Bam Bam and Fatu causes a double tag. Samu sends Bam Bam flying with a great back body drop. Samu gets a near fall with a top rope falling headbutt, but Bam Bam kicks out before the three. Some nice double team action from the Headshrinkers, culminating in a quite ugly double reverse Russian leg sweep at IRS and a splash, but with a double distraction from Ted DiBiase distracting the ref and Bam Bam Bigelow baking up the pin that stopped that. The match just broke down in the end, ended in an apparent DQ, and I think according to the official results, Bam Bam and IRS won by DQ. Colin, as an hour ago, this was below par. My main takeaway from this is there a more oddball pairing than IRS and Bam Bam Bigelow?
I think you pair IRS with anybody, and it's an oddball pairing. It's one of the weirder combinations, but I mean, IRS as a character, he barely talks. He wears a shirt and tie in the ring and carries a briefcase as well. He's a tax man. I mean, I know we're in a company that enjoys a character as a gimmick, but I mean, it's an awful character. And to pair him with the tattoo headed, fire emblazoned tights that he wears, big man, it's a really odd one. But I mean, it's Ted DiBiase's $1 million corporation, so I suppose he makes whoever the team, whoever he wants it to be.
Thoughts on the match, Colin?
I mean, for what it was okay. I mean, I think the fans would have been into it a bit more if the tag titles were on the line like they thought they would be going into the night. The disqualification and the brawl at the end, I mean, they basically brawled out of the arena, so you'd assume that this probably isn't the last time we see these two teams fight.
Chris?
Pretty much the same, you know. It was some good double team moves in there. You know, both teams worked well with each other. I'm not a fan of having a DQ finish like that in your first match of the night. I'd prefer to have sort of a distinctive sort of tone set with a winner and a loser at the beginning. But it was an okay match, you know. Always surprised with how agile Bam Bam is. You know, seeing a guy of his size do some of the stuff that he does is massively impressive.
No, completely. Yeah, it was an okay opener. I didn't really, as you say, I mean, I think the explanation, I think, was Wade Keller said that the logic behind putting the tag titles on Diesel and Shawn was that Diesel's about to lose the Intercontinental title and they want to keep him strong, so keep him with and championship, although he was only, only Intercontinental and tag team champion for about, a day or so. But yeah, it was fine, but again, there is no worldly reason other than the fact Ted DiBiase manages them both that these two will be together, and they don't seem to have much chemistry or much reason to belong together. And it's certainly not a tag team I think I'd want to pursue much more. Then we cut to first of a few Leslie Nielsen segments investigating The Undertaker. Colin, we'll address these now. These were awful.
Just terrible. I'd like to have been in a meeting where somebody suggested that, you know, we have Leslie Nielsen and the Naked Gun team do an investigation into where The Undertaker is. Because...
And they didn't even solve it!
No, they didn't.
Surely you bring in Leslie Nielsen, he solves the thing. We'll come to it at the end, but we get to the post-match of the main event, and he's sneaking by an open casket, and then he goes, look! And he walks over, and there's a briefcase, and he goes, well, it must be case closed. This whole thing set up for a bad pun at the end.
A really bad pun.
Chris?
Oh, dear.
It's terrible.
Shall we move on?
Yes, because nothing else to really go with after what Colin said, really.
I will come to those. I will mention those points as we get to them. Then we have Bull Nakano versus Alundra Blaze for the Women's Championship. Alundra Blaze comes out wearing a big cape. And then Bull Nakano, I wrote down that it seemed like both competitors were trying to outdo each other in the dress stakes. as Bull Nakano came out with the best hair I have ever seen in a wrestling match before, or probably since, or after even, in terms that she, I don't even know if it was real hair, she had like normal long hair, and then at the front had like a foot of hair spiked straight up.
I have it on good authority that it is her real hair.
Right, that's good to know. But at one point, Alundra Blaze did set up for a pile driver, and I thought, well, that's probably not going to hurt much, she'll just bounce. but we had Flower Girls presenting both competitors with flowers, but shockingly, Luna Vachon, who was in the corner of Bull Nakano, took her bunch and whacked Alundra Blaze over the back of it. Nakano dominated the early proceedings, tossing Blaze around the ring, using her hair for the advantage. Blaze hit a lovely Hurricane Rana, but only got a two count. Nakano locked in what I had as a kind of Boston Crab sharpshooter hybrid, underscored by rallying USA chants as Nakano kind of comes from Japan. Then locked in a lovely submission, which was kind of a scorpion with a body lift, which got a really good reaction from the crowd, who were very impressed with that. Blaze go for a roll-up, but Nakano roll it into what looked like an armbar, but Dave Meltzer was saying that apparently that's kind of quite a big move in Japan, but neither the announced team, shockingly Vince McMahon, or I think any of the American audience really got the significance of that move.
Was it what a maneuver?
Possibly. Yeah. And then Blaze got some momentum with the crowd rallied behind her, set up for a pile driver, but as Lawler says, quote, she'll break her hair. That's Nakano, of course. We've got a backside for a two count. Blaze goes for another Hurricane Rana, but Nakano sits out into a powerbomb. Nakano then goes to the top rope for a leg drop, misses. Blaze stands her up, hits a German suplex with pin. And, Chris, the crowd went bonkers, and they were really into this.
Which is quite refreshing to see that you give Alondra Blaze someone to work with and she pulls out a great match. It was really, really good wrestling, so the crowd appreciate a good show. And I would quite happily see this again. I will take a Bull Nakano Alondra Blaze match again.
Colin.
I said earlier on, I'm not a massive fan of the women's wrestling. I don't find it very easy to get into. But it was a good women's match. And as you said, Bob, when Alondra Blaze got the pin, the crowd popped like crazy. It's probably one of the bigger pops of the night. They are really into Alondra Blaze. I mean, I don't know if it was anything to do with the USA beating Japan or if they just do actually genuinely like and are behind Alondra Blaze, but it was an okay women's match. It was enjoyable enough for me, and I'm not really a fan of them.
No, it wasn't too long, which I have criticism of a couple of matches later on being too long. The action was good, and it was one of those things where, like, Nakano played a very convincing heel, and I think part of it was the whole kind of representing Japan thing that made her easy to boo, but she played her role very well. And Alondra Blaze is someone that's very easy to get behind as a face in that kind of scenario. And the action was great. And you put all those things together in front of a hot crowd. And as I say, when we mentioned in the news about the crowd being kind of silent for the main event, the crowd were into a lot of things on this show. So it's not like the crowd was silent for the whole show. It was primarily for the main event. But a really good match. Then we cut backstage for an interview with Shawn Michaels and Diesel, the new tag team champions. We got another, I've got here another Wooden Diesel promo, slightly better than his last Wooden Diesel promo, but still pretty wooden. Then we get to the match, Diesel with Shawn Michaels versus Razor Ramon with Sweetness, Walter Payton, the NFL player, for the Intercontinental title. We start the match with Razor flicking his toothpick at Diesel, which gives the match some edge at the top of the match. High energy start, if a bit clunky, Razor whips Diesel into the corner, but runs into an elbow on the follow-up. With the ref distracted, Shawn Michaels unties the turnbuckle pad. He heads towards Razor Ramon on the outside, but Payton stands up to him, much to the crowd's enjoyment. Shockingly, the ref goes outside to talk to a monitor Payton, but not Michaels. Michaels uses the distraction to hit Razor with a flying forearm by the ring steps running round the other side of the ring. Diesel lines up whipping Razor into the exposed ring post, but Earl Hebner stands on the first turnbuckle and stops that. I thought that was quite nice. Michaels then jumps on top of the ropes. The ref reprimands him, but Diesel does it anyway. Razor bounces Diesel off the turnbuckle, but the roll-up only gets two. Razor ducks under the big boot in the corner, slides to the outside, then crotches him on the ring post, then goes for a top rope bull rock and a scoop slam, but only gets two. Payton then wrestles the title belt off Shawn Michaels, who's trying to get involved. The ref once again reprimands Payton, but this time Michaels' interference sees him hit a sweet chin music on Diesel after Razor ducks out of the way. Then after a fair bit of waiting, Razor crawls over and pins Diesel for the three count and wins the title. Diesel chases after Shawn. He is not happy. Colin, I thought the match here was good, but I thought the stuff with Shawn Michaels and Walter Payton made it a very good match.
Yeah, I mean, I was a bit sceptical at first when I heard that they were going to get this NFL Hall of Famer, Walter Payton, involved, because, you know, he's an outsider. And he's there because he's famous in the town that the show is in. You can understand
Let's just say he was slightly better than the last NFL player that was involved in a pay-per-view.
Yeah.
We might talk about that.
Yeah. Actually, Walter Payton and Shawn Michaels helped make the match a lot more enjoyable. Their outside parts involving both of them were quite enjoyable to watch. They added to the match, which I was fearful that Walter Payton was going to be given some spots that might take away and wouldn't really work because he's not really involved with wrestling. But it was a good match with good outside interference, if you like, if you want to call it that, and the crowd liked it, so did I.
Chris?
I thought that the Razor Shawn match was amazing. I would definitely have it again. It was a fantastic story told by everyone in the match. Shawn's facials and his mannerisms when cheating and trying to distract the ref was absolutely priceless. These three, Shawn, Razor and Diesel, I can all see taking the next step up and being in the hunt for the WF title pretty soon and not just around the IC title. All three of them are, to me, the future of the company.
Yeah, no, I think they're all being kind of pushed in that direction. Be interested to see where someone like Owen Hart fits in that. But beyond that, you're right, yeah, these are the guys on the up compared to, you know, Lex Luger and Yokozuna, wherever he was. I thought this was a decent match with some very good stuff going on around the ring that really lifted it up a couple of pegs. I don't think your average Diesel Razor match at this stage is gonna pull up any trees, but I think there were enough antics to cover for the fact so that kind of Diesel and Razor didn't have to go too long or do too much kind of wrestling or selling at times. But Shawn and Walter Payton really added to this match. Didn't go too long. The finish was quite satisfying too. They kind of suggested a conflict between Shawn and Diesel, who are obviously tag champions now as well. But no, I thought it was a good match, but was certainly improved by what was going on outside. We'll move on to a backstage interview with Todd Pettengill, who stood between Lex Luger and Tatanka. Todd said that an opinion poll conducted on the 900 line said that 54% of voters said that Lex Luger had sold out to Ted DiBiase. Tatanka said that he knows that Luger has sold out. Tatanka cut a promo. What I didn't like about this was that Tatanka cut a promo and they perfectly overlaid images, cutting it exactly the point where he changed topics, which I thought was a bit weird for what was essentially meant to be a live interview. Luger says that DiBiase can do what he likes, it's a free country, and that he did not sell out. A great moment as Lex Luger came out, as Vince McMahon said, well, you know, obviously the crowd aren't popping for Lex Luger because, you know, they're confused, or rather than the fact that he's just not that over. So the pair began by bickering in the ring, the referee breaks them up. Despite the fact the match had already started, the ref pulled them apart, despite the fact the bell had already rung. Even going early on with Tatanka working on Lex Luger's arm to little effect and Luger getting a roll up for a two count. Tatanka missed a crossbody from the top rope. Luger hit a pair of intense clotheslines and out walks Ted DiBiase carrying a bag of money and offering it to Luger. Tatanka picks on the distraction, goes for a roll-up, and gets the three count. After the match, DiBiase stepped into the ring, and as Luger and Tatanka were arguing, Luger turns to DiBiase, kicks the money away, but then Tatanka attacks Luger from behind, aligning himself with DiBiase. The pair hug. The beat count continues, and nobody comes out to help Lex Luger, which is wonderful. Maybe nobody does like him. Maybe the lack of crowd reaction stems to the locker room too. And then Tatanka puts the $1 million dream submission on Luger. Dead DiBiase looks very pleased. Chris, your thoughts on this?
At least it was quick and painless. I absolutely hated it. I could see Tatanka was gonna turn sort of really early on in the match. It furthers the story, but I could do without seeing it again. It's one of those, at least it's done now.
Got it.
Well, unfortunately, I don't think it is done because, you know, Lex Luger's got to get his revenge.
Lex Luger's started about four feuds this year that haven't gone anywhere, so maybe that's the gimmick.
Yeah, but then what else has he got going on, really?
Well, that's true.
It's a standard Tatanka match. They're never really anything too in depth. They're not really a technical wrestling match, which in fairness suits Luger as well because he's not that great a technical wrestler either. I think I think very early on in the feud, all the build-up on WWF television, I think it was always obvious where they were going to go, because they weren't going to turn Lex Luger back this soon after they had their stellar failure of a push for him. Yeah, I think Tatanka has really been quite irrelevant ever since they ended his undefeated streak. And this is the only way they can try and use him in a different way, because otherwise there's not much use for him anyway.
I like how at the top of the show I said about the oddball pairing of IRS and Bam Bam Bigelow. I think the perfect third wheel for that would have to be Tatanka in the Ted DiBiase stable. I don't know of three wrestlers that complement each other less than those three. That all being said, the match was nothing to write home about, but Chris, as you say, it was short. I thought the main event, I thought the actual angle that finished it was quite effective. Whether it was predictable or not is maybe a matter for discussion, but I thought the crowd were quite into it. I don't know that everyone saw it coming. I'm intrigued. Not much more, but I'm intrigued to see where it's going. I'm glad they didn't turn Luger. I still think that as much as Luger's kind of, you know, they've probably given up on him as being a main event player, I still think he can be a very solid kind of upper mid-card babyface. And there's nothing wrong with that role. He's the kind of guy they can prime, they can put him with Diesel soon, or I guess those matches could get quite ugly. But that's the kind of feud where, like, Luger can be a stepping stone for Diesel before he gets to Bret Hart. But I thought the angle was effective. I think Wade Keller made a good point when he said that it would have been more effective perhaps if Tatanka hadn't been kind of such a jerk beforehand to Luger, rather than, you know, if he'd have been a bit more honourable and said, well, you know, I think you've turned, but I would never do that. Whereas more he's kind of getting quite angry with Luger, to the point where, okay, I guess you should sympathise with Luger given that he's the face, but it probably made the turn slightly less shocking. But no, I thought the angle was quite effective, and the match was about as good as it was going to get, and thankfully it wasn't very long. Then we get to Jeff Jarrett versus Mabel. So we started the match. Mabel did his own version of the Jarrett strut, which got a good pop. Jarrett did a leapfrog to Mabel, which is very impressive. He then lied on the floor, going for that old kind of chain wrestling style, run off the ropes. But Mabel just stood there and just dropped an elbow, which is quite funny. Mabel does a nice spinning back heel kick, as he always does. Then we get Knuckleball Schwartz in the crowd, who walks out and does nothing for the entire show, as far as I can see. Knuckleball Schwartz is a baseball player. That's the gimmick. Amazing. Jarrett goes for a sunset flip. Mabel sits down on it, but Jarrett moves and gets the quick three count. Colin, this was bad, so bad that I'd forgotten about it. I'm almost tempted just to skip, but your brief thoughts on this show, and correct me if I'm wrong, Knuckleball Schwartz, did he appear again? I didn't imagine that, did I?
No, he was in the crowd with his I'm on strike sign. That's just Vince's way of getting a little reference to the Major League Baseball strike that's currently ongoing.
That's it. If I followed MLS, I'd probably
literally
know.
That is the only relevant thing that happened in this match, because you can talk about the next one if you like. It was rubbish.
Didn't enjoy it.
I quite like Jeff's jumping sleeper. That was about it.
Yeah, no. In the brevity we got, Jarrett did a couple of impressive things. There were a few minor high points in what was otherwise a snoozer. But I don't get the Mabel thing.
No,
like he's just really fat. That is the gimmick. And you know, we've had really fat wrestlers in the past be really over, but he's not really over. And in a tag team, you know, with kind of Oscar rapping, Oscar's still there, but I don't know where Moe's gone. In a tag team, maybe, you know, they're all dressed up, bit of music, like Mabel can come in and do a couple of moves at the end of a 4-minute match, maybe that'll work. As a single, I don't know where this is going. I've no idea. And
they seem to have this,
I say that, he lost, so, you know, maybe
he's... They seem to have this obsession of trying to put him over as one of those agile big men. But in reality, he's not really that agile. The spinning heel kick that he does is nothing more really than a front roll that he just leaves his foot up in the air as he's going down.
Yeah.
I really just don't understand the fascination with this guy.
Chris, why don't we put him in the stable with Tatanka, Bam Bam Bigelow and IRS?
Yes. And he can, because, you know, he can be the token guy for the whole group, and no one will know why they're all together other than money. Put dollar signs on all of their bums, on all the gear. They're there for the money.
Don't put dollar signs on Mabel's bum.
You'd have to need about seven of them.
Yeah.
He could still wear shiny gold.
Yes. Yeah,
that would sort of make sense. And have purple dollar signs, because he likes purple.
Do you think the whole idea of the $1 million stable is just to hoover up all the really terrible gimmicks, like throw in Sparky Plug, throw in Knuckleball Schwartz, throw in Duke the Dumpster Druzy, throw in Adam Bomb, just all of the terrible gimmicks, and then, like Ted DiBiase gets exported, and it turns out he's paying them all, and they can fire them all.
Yes. I like this thinking.
Yes, as good an explanation of this stable as any, because there's not really much else in this.
Let me move on. Right, after this match, we were setting up for the cage match, so we had a lot of time to kill. In amongst some video packages, Vince McMahon says there are, quote, super sleuths amongst the crowd attempting to solve the mystery of The Undertaker. And then we had a... Colin, who was the other bloke? There was Leslie Nielsen. Who was the other guy?
That was his partner out of the film, wasn't it? I can't remember what his name is. He's as irrelevant as the whole little shtick they did.
Yeah, they were I think he was on the entrance ramp. They were stood kind of in the crowd next to the opening, and then behind them, The Undertaker was there.
They were in the crowd, yet they were in the aisleway where the crowd wasn't allowed to go.
That's right. And they seemed, you would think, as I said earlier, you would think you bring in Leslie Nielsen and he would solve the case. Yeah. He did not solve the case. He didn't get close to solving the case.
George Kennedy.
Oh, well done.
Well done.
Good to see someone's taking notes. I don't even remember the name George Kennedy being said at any point during the show, but
he says by George, and then he's standing there and it's by George.
I think we've devoted too much time to this already.
Full name him.
Right. They know sold his surname. So Vince McMahon was interviewing the Hart family at ringside. Colin, the British Bulldog's back, and he looks completely different. He's even bigger than he was before, which in the shadow of the steroid trial I thought was quite funny. He's got this kind of long, matted hair, kind of parted down the middle, so it's kind of like going down the side of his face.
It's like a big mane.
That's right. Yeah, it's kind of all frayed. It's all dry.
Yeah,
and then he's wearing these massive frame glasses, this big, like, tan leather gilet, almost, sleeveless, so he could show off his guns. And there he was in the front row, surrounded by the Hart family. There was Bruce, there was Keith, there was Stu, there was Helen, I think there was Bulldog's wife, whatever the sister's called. Diana, good shout. There was one more, and then behind there was Jim the Anvil Neidhart, who's obviously is siding with Owen in all this. So while they're building the cage, Vince McMahon interviews them. Not much of any real note is said, I don't think. Although Vince McMahon did say that for once the cage is actually to keep people out of the ring, not keep the competitors in the ring, which is quite interesting. We cut backstage to a Brett promo, which you've heard at the start of this segment. And then we get to the match, and if you think my match reviews have been long, this match lasted 30 minutes, so this match is going to be quite long. So Owen attacked Brett as he climbed into the cage and then immediately got the upper hand. Brett did a lovely running bulldog from the corner. Brett tried to escape by the door, as does Owen. Brett then climbed the cage, but Owen throws him back into the ring for a big bump. Owen gets halfway over the cage, but Brett then keeps him in it, but things spill back into the inside. Owen kicks Brett off before hitting a lovely drop kick. Brett goes to climb the corner. Owen yanks him back into the ring, and Brett lands quite violently on the top rope. Owen at one point is being saved from Brett by hanging almost on his hair. Brett then ascends the cage, but Owen catches him in a torture rack position and hits a Samoan drop. Owen hits a pile driver on Brett. Owen knocks Brett to the floor while climbing, but appears to fall badly and flip over the rope. Brett scrambles to the door, but Owen just about gets him in time just by the door. Brett, after going for the wrong corner, because he was a bit disorientated, slides to go out by the door, but Owen does a lovely swan dive and cuts him off before he can get out. Owen goes to escape in the corner, but Brett goes after him and superplexes him back into the ring. Brett goes to escape after a long delay, selling the move, but Owen locks in a sharpshooter. Brett reverses it somehow into his own sharpshooter for a very impressive spot. Both climb to the outside. Brett ties up Owen's legs, kind of back through into the ring and then falls to victory and wins the match and retains the WWF title. After the match, Anvil climbs over the guardrail, which is kind of on the entrance ramp, and kind of Bulldog and Diana are sat two rows in front. He lines up, runs, clotheslines Bulldog from behind, knocking Bulldog and Diana over the guardrail into the ring. He then bundles Brett back into the ring, locks the cage door with Owen obviously now inside, and they then have a breakdown of him as the family try and climb into the ring, but the Anvil managed to keep him out. Eventually the faces do get in. I think it was Bruce and Keith who were helping Bulldog. But the heels escape via the corner and run off to end the match. Colin, what did you think of this?
I thought it's probably as good as a cage match as you're ever going to see. It kept me entertained the whole way through. I mean, I think you said earlier on it was a bit too long. I didn't notice.
I thought it was a fraction too. Like, I thought kind of because of the limitations of the cage match, I kind of felt that they about 20 odd minutes in, they kept kind of reprising the same spots a few times. Kind of big move in the ring, one goes to climb, the other one just gets there in time, throws them back into the ring, they sell for a bit, and they go again. So I thought it was maybe 3 or 4 minutes too long, and I kind of felt the crowd tailed off a fraction. They popped big at the end, but I kind of thought they would have crescendoed a little bit earlier. I'm not saying it was, you know, it was a 31-minute match. I'm not saying it was 10 minutes too long, but maybe 3 or 4.
Okay, well, first, I mean, I suppose I can understand a little bit where you're coming from. I mean, there was a few times when they went to get out over the top of the cage, and it seemed a bit samey, but overall, I mean, it's silly to say that Brett and Owen have got great chemistry. Of course they do. You know, they've known each other all their lives, so they should have. I think any time you're going to put Brett and Owen together, I mean, you had them in the match at WrestleMania 10. You followed it up with this cage match for the title now. I just think it's a perfect technical match that I would watch over and over again, because I don't think you'd see much of the same thing in every single time they fight.
Chris?
I absolutely love this match. I loved the beginning when it started, they kicked off each other and they were punching each other because they don't like each other. You know, there was no sort of going in for headlocks or lockups or anything like that to start with. They went all out straight away to go after each other. You know, it set the tone. I like how they used the cage. They didn't overuse it. They weren't sort of there pushing each other's faces into it and, you know, doing the let's sort of rest hold with the cage. A few times there was a few of the sort of diving to keep them in the ring or get them back over the cage where you're like, why don't you just drop down? You'd have won. But, yeah.
You always get that in this kind of match, don't you, though, really?
Yeah, take the broken ankle, you'd be the world champion. But the superplex in this was just absolutely beautiful. When the Brett superplex was just great.
This was from kind of like three rungs from the top of the cage, so it wasn't just off the turnbuckle. Brett had to kind of like grab Owen from climbing over the corner, and then obviously he wasn't like right on the top, but he was probably about two or three rungs down. Hit a lovely superplex back into the middle of the ring.
So you call it picture perfect.
Yes.
I don't know if you noticed, but at some point during the match, Owen's right boot comes undone and is pretty loose. So the fact that he'd done pretty much half the match with only one boot on properly makes it a little bit more impressive that he could dive around and do some of the things that he was doing with a loose shoe.
Yeah, very good, very good. Yeah, I mean, this was about as good a cage match as it could have possibly been. Maybe a fraction long, but as well as they did with it, I didn't love the cage match stipulation. It made sense from a point of view of keeping the guys out, but one thing I never loved about cage matches is, to me, it doesn't make sense for a babyface to want to try and win a match of this significance by escaping a cage. It makes perfect sense for the heels to try and win in such a lousy way, but I almost kind of would have said, look, erect the cage, if you want to do that, fine, because it makes sense because you want to keep Anvil out, that makes sense. But why not have pinfalls and submissions in the ring rather than having all of these spots over and over again? Because it limited what they could do between the escape parts, because they, you can't really build up much momentum because you kept just going back to escape. As I say, it was a fine, fine match for the parameters that they set. I just think the parameters they set might have limited it a little bit. That being said, there were some exceptional spots. The superplex was excellent. The sharpshooter reversed into another sharpshooter was very good as well. And the crowd was super into it. As I say, I think if it had ended 4 or 5 minutes before, the pop would have been slightly bigger. But the match ended with both of them climbing down the side nearest to the entrance ramp. They were kind of side by side, and then Brett managed to kind of lock Owen's leg between the cage and the rope. And then jump down for the victory. Chris, we haven't spoken about the post-match antics yet with the anvil, not locking Brett back inside the cage with Owen, but I thought that was excellent.
Yeah, other than the fact that Anvil couldn't get that padlock shut, which thankfully Bruce and Keith did quite well to, you know, sell it
cover
enough
up, yeah.
That he was having a few difficulties. But I loved it when the good brothers finally got in and Anvil and Owen scarpered as quick as possible, like naughty little children.
Yeah, I mean, it was only ever going to be believable to a point that two guys on the inside could restrict three guys on the outside from climbing in. I thought they just about held it for as long as they could. And then I actually was quite happy with kind of like the faces were kind of clambering three sides. So the other two ran for a corner and climbed up that and kind of shimmied up and down. Although you kind of wonder, given how quickly I managed to get out, why you didn't get out like 5 minutes earlier at that pace and win the match.
Don't mention that.
Sorry. So, yeah, I guess Anvil, like, it would have made more sense if Anvil would have put him on his shoulders and clambered him out, but whatever.
Yeah,
but,
I mean...
Colin, go on.
The only bit that made me laugh, really, with that last bit after the match, when Anvil clotheslined Bulldog and Diana over the barricade, why did he clothesline Bulldog?
Well, no, I think the idea was that Bulldog, obviously they're bringing back Bulldog, I presume, to wrestle in a variation of this match, presumably at Survivor Series. I think the idea was that Bruce and Keith, who aren't really major wrestlers, aren't that much of a physical threat, but you're going to try and keep Bulldog strong. To complete the action of getting Brett back into the ring, you need to eliminate Bulldog. That was how I interpreted it.
Okay, well,
It looks a bit convoluted, given that he hit Bulldog and Diana decided to flip over the rail as well. But what that did do was that it meant that the Hart's family were concerned with Diana, as was Bulldog, which bought the other guy's time. So that kind of made sense as well. It looks a bit convoluted, but I think there was logic behind it.
Were we aware that the Bulldog's contract with WCW was up?
He left in January. Yeah, I think they fired him for not turning up, I think.
Oh good.
I'll let you off for forgetting something we said on the show about 6 months ago. But go on, Chris.
As we said, Anvil should be punished for crimes against fashion, though. Whoever said it was a good idea
Anvil?
To wear...
Anvil? A bulldog, surely?
Oh, come on. It was
Anvil.
Yeah,
the
Anvil,
tights with shorts over them and a bum bag.
The tights were blue and black striped tights. They weren't just plain colour tights. You could try and pass it off.
Yeah, all right. I tell you, we'll have him and Bulldog in a fashion match. I don't know what that is, but yeah, I thought Bulldog. I say with the kind of like the parted hair down the middle, like matted, dry, bit of a perm almost, and then the big reading glasses. He was completely unrecognisable from the Bulldog that left WCW at the beginning of the year. But no, I thought this was a terrific match. As I say, that Brett and Owen, when presented with the idea, you've got to do a cage match. This was as good as it was going to get. They can't do blood, so they couldn't even do much stuff with like raking people along the cage or kind of doing many kind of spots bouncing off the cage, because at some point, in theory, you've got to bleed. But it got a fraction repetitive, but it was about as good as we could get. The post-match angle was excellent. We've got Bulldog back in this feud, which presumably means we're going to get a tag match at some point. A really good match. So obviously as we had to have a delay before this match to assemble the cage, we had to have another delay before the main event to disassemble the cage. So we also got a big long video package wrapping up exactly the Undertaker versus Undertaker story. Didn't get anything more from Leslie Nielsen until the end of the show. Again, like, didn't exactly solve anything. But then we got to the match. Well, I'm going to tell you what happened beforehand as well. But we had obviously the Undertaker with Ted DiBiase versus the Undertaker with Paul Bearer. So some druids come out pushing a casket onto the entrance ramp with the real taker. Bearer goes for the real taker. He wasn't in it. Bearer goes inside the casket and pulls out a huge urn. It was like Paul Bearer's head was big. This was about 50% bigger, massive. Bearer takes the top off. Obviously, he didn't just like unscrew it. He like pretended it was like levitating almost. And then the lid comes off, and there's a big torchlight shining from inside the urn. Then we get a lot of thunder and lightning effects, which is obviously the return of the real Undertaker. The fake one's already out there by this point. And then out comes the real Undertaker. Massive pop. Huge. Probably the pop of the night. It was great. They went with it. And then the match began. We've got the real Undertaker and the fake Undertaker. They're both dressed almost identically, but the real Undertaker has kind of purple gloves and purple accents on his kind of socks, or it might have been purple socks, actually. And the fake Undertaker had grey gloves with grey socks. And then the match started, and this match lasted 7 minutes. It felt every bit of them. The crowd was just stunned into silence, maybe just at how bad this angle was, rather than in awe, as Vince McMahon tried to play off. Incredibly slow pace, not much of any real note, as our cup kind of towards the end. Fake Taker hits the real Taker with a chokeslam. Fake Taker hits the real Taker with a tombstone. Taker sits up after both of them. Fake Taker goes for a second tombstone, but the real Taker reverses it into his own tombstone, hits a second one, then hits a third, and then I put in my notes, mercifully it ends, and afterwards the druids come out to take the fake Taker away. Chris.
You pretty much summed it up with the, thankfully it was short and ended.
It wasn't that short. It was 8 minutes and it felt them.
The zombie combination of, you know, Monster Zombie 1 versus Monster Zombie 2 will do everything really slowly. Just should never be done again. We've seen it once. We realize it doesn't work. Never go back there. Though, at least, you know, for one thing, we didn't get what I was saying last month with, you know, mirror mode, that one was in a different colour, so it was easy to tell which one was which.
I don't know. I mean, I as much as I think the crowd were dead for this, I think, given how big the arena was, I think it might have been easy either to forget or not be able to see. And I don't think them being dressed almost identically helped this match in any way. I know obviously it kind of makes sense, but maybe this was the time for Real Taker to evolve ever so slightly, you know, change his ring gear ever so slightly, so a bit more than that.
He has purple now.
Purple gloves.
Yeah, and purple socks. Don't forget the purple socks.
All right, gloves and socks. But yeah, no, I don't think them looking almost identical helped this match. Not that I think the crowd would have gone ballistic otherwise. But Corin, this was just bad. And the company thought they haven't changed their plans on the back of this match. They decided within the last few weeks that this wasn't going to go anywhere. But the company believed when they started this thing back, I think at the very end of April, I think was when I first mentioned it on the show, about when they had the Undertaker sightings. They thought this match was going to restart the company fortunes. They were wrong.
Oh, massively. I think Chris said it best, actually, that the fact that both men worked the match in that slow, methodical pace that The Undertaker works his matches just killed the crowd completely, because there was no wrestler was able to get any momentum. Because as soon as one of them got the upper hand, it took them another minute to do the next move. There wasn't a quick succession of moves, which you're trying to build the crowd up to the point where you hit the finish, they pop, brilliant. But it wasn't able to happen in this match because of the speed it was worked at.
Yeah, no, it was just bad. It was really bad. And you think that this could have ended with the cage match. Now, okay, this ended on a positive note with the real Undertaker overcoming the fake one. But you think that this show could have ended with the Bret Owen cage match. And I think had the show ended at that point, even exactly as it went down with kind of the heels ending on top, I think this would have ended as a really good show. But let's find out. Chris, your overall brief thoughts on the show and a score rating.
As I said at the beginning, when it's good, it was very, very good. When it was bad, it was terrible. Three awesome matches. out of the seven. I'm giving it 6 out of 10, and it's because when it was good, it was so good that it brings up the average of the rubbish of the rest of it. If I never see a Taker-Taker match ever again, I will die a happy man.
As the fake Taker probably did. Colin?
Yeah, I had it down as a 6 as well. The great championship matches that they had were unfortunately a little bit overshadowed by the really bad matches that they also had, and that main event is without doubt one of the worst in WWF has ever put on. So yeah, I think 6 is a fair show.
Yeah, I was in at 5.5. Same kind of story, really. I mean, what I guess we can do. Chris, if this show had ended at the end of the title match, what would your score rating have been?
It would have probably been a 7 or 8.
Colin?
Yeah, I think it would have been a 7.
Yeah, I'd have been a 7.5, 8. That was how much it dragged it down, really. It was just that bad. And it's like, if you'd have put this on in the middle and then had the title match at the end, I don't think things would have been half as bad. But it was just, as I said with Starrcade, and as I think I said with Bash of the Beach last month, so much is on the main event. So much of how I perceive a show is kind of how do you leave people. And you can have an average show with a great main event, it's a really good show. You can have a very good show, as this one I think was, with a terrible main event, it drags the whole thing down.
It didn't help with the fact that there was the long period before and after the cage match.
No, that's true.
With putting the cage up and down. So, the buzz
thing. All the more reason to have that at the end, you would have thought.
The fact that they had to disassemble the cage after the match just was ridiculous.
Go on.
Obviously, the buzz at the end of that title match, everyone's like, that was awesome. You're waiting 5-10 minutes for him to take the cage down. Then the long-winded entrances to get a slow-paced match.
If the match had been good, I think that the pausing in between would have helped, because I think the crowd probably would have wanted to come down. But again, once the match started, it was a shitstorm, really. That's the only way I can describe it. It was awful. And then to end, recap, our final recap, we cut backstage with Leslie Nielsen, as we now know, George Kennedy, stood by an open casket, and they're kind of, well, did we solve the case of The Undertaker? Well, they thought they did. And then George Kennedy goes, look, there's a briefcase. Who knows what? It was closed, and case closed. And that is where we will end our review of this. Moving on to the WWF television review, not a ton to report, they haven't really kind of already covered in the SummerSlam review, but August the 1st, Raw saw a long and really, really good Razor Ramon Shawn Michaels match building to the Razor Diesel match on SummerSlam, and a King's Court segment where Bob Backlund's back, and he said that he never gave up the WWF title and he never submitted, and he says he wants the title back. I have no idea where that's going. On the 8th of August, we had a King's Court segment with Lawler, Owen Hart and Jim the Anvil Neidhart. Owen said it was like wrestling in the dungeon, except when he beat Bret this time it will be for the WWF title. Owen said the whole family had turned on Bret, but Bruce Hart came out and said that Owen was lying, that he'd always been the jealous brother and he needed to hide behind the anvil to do his dirty work for him.
Alright, you gotta love that. Dusty, you're gonna be back in the ring, but the questions I'm asked by fans as I travel around the country, Dusty's not been in a ring for a while. Is he gonna be ready for a test like this?
Gee, let me tell you what it's really all about, baby. It's about family. It's about blood. It's about every black, white, green, yellow person walking the face of the earth, baby. That's what it's all about. Emotions carry you. Emotions, no matter what your age, carry you to do things. It is a pleasure to ride this lightning bolt with my son. It is a pleasure to ride this lightning bolt into the heartland of America. It is a pleasure to ride this lightning bolt on the Clash of Champions. It is a pleasure to kick somebody's booty on television around the world. Colonel Parker, we're talking about Gals Buck. We're talking about that egg-sucking dog, Terry Funk. Gentlemen, real plainly, you have an opportunity of a lifetime. You have an opportunity at greatness, but you will have to prove that this old out of shape, spindly legged, big butted boy from Austin, Texas can have his butt whipped in public, if you will. It is an honor to be with my son. Everybody out there, grab your son, grab your mother, grab your family, because without family, it just ain't worth it. And if they say, what about your carpet situation? They take my carpet situation and they can take that job and shove it, baby.
And moving on to Clash of the Champions. Colin, the results.
In the opener, the Nasty Boys defeated Paul Roma and Paul Orndorff in a tag team match. Ricky the Dragon Steamboat defeated Steve Austin in a match for the WCW United States Championship. Dusty and Dustin Rhodes defeated the team of Terry Funk and Buckhouse Buck by disqualification. Antonio Inoki defeated Lord Steven Regal in a singles match, and in the main event, Ric Flair defeated Hulk Hogan by countout in the WCW World Heavyweight Championship match.
And Hogan retains his title. Chris, your overall thoughts on the show?
Not as good as last month's Bash, but I liked it. It was a solid sort of program. There's a little bit too much of the hospital stuff with, you know, Hogan, after Hogan being attacked, will he, won't he come back? But the match quality, all of them were good matches.
Yeah, just to fill in briefly, I mean, we will touch on it as the show goes on, but after the opening match, Hulk Hogan came out to presumably cut a promo with Mean Gene Oakland, got attacked from behind with a masked assassin, really, with a lead pipe, and hit him in the back of the knee. Hogan writhed around in pain. They took him off to hospital. The rest of the show was, can he get back in time, and will he get back in the ring? And then he did. But there was a lot of stuff surrounding that throughout the show, which we'll come to as and when we get to it. Colin?
We're talking about the Hogan bit. I didn't mind the storyline, actually. I think it added a little bit to the show. I've seen a lot of WCW events, and this was by far one of the better ones in my mind. I've seen a hell of a lot worse. I actually quite enjoyed all the matches on the card.
I don't have to sound so surprised, because
the Nasty Boys were on the card.
Well, true.
I don't tend to enjoy Nasty Boys matches, but it was okay. I was pleasantly surprised. I quite enjoyed the show. I even partly enjoyed the Hogan storyline, which I think did go a little bit over the top, but it was all right.
Yeah, no, I'd have to agree in the sense that I thought the Hogan story, it was convoluted in parts and there were some continuity errors, which I'll come to. I actually thought it added a lot to the show in that it gave it kind of a concurrent theme going throughout the show. It kind of, obviously we're on TV, don't forget, so you've got to give people a reason to stick around after the opener once they've tuned in. So the angle with Hogan, will he get back in time? I thought that was quite a clever little thing. Took away from a couple of matches, given that they're focusing more on that angle than they were on the match going on in the ring. And the main event match was pretty good. We will start with the now babyface Nasty Boys versus Pretty Wonderful. That's Paul Orndorff and Paul Roma. The Nasties dominated the opening 2-on-1 in both Roma and the legal man Paul Orndorff. A big clothesline to Sags on the outside, which the cameraman largely missed, or the director did, as did the referee. Orndorff then chokes Sags on the outside with a camera cable. Sag gets his head rammed into the ring steps and then sells for a long time on the outside. Back in the ring, Roma sounds Sags and then fluently jumps to the top rope before hitting a nice elbow drop from the top rope. Sags then plays the babyface in peril, which is not something you ever thought you'd hear yourself say. We even got brief Nasties chants from the crowd, so they were at least beginning to get over as faces. Sags came round, but just as he was building some momentum, he got blindsided by Orndorff. Again, the referee missed this. Orndorff goes for a pile driver, but Sag reverses it, and the crowd went with that. We then had a very odd finish where we had Paul Roma on the top of one turnbuckle in his corner. Brian Knobbs on the turnbuckle in his corner. Sags and Orndorff laying in the ring. They both hit kind of stereo splashes. And then the ref decided to count the Knobbs on Orndorff pin. And I'm not particularly sure whether that was correct or not, because I'm not particularly sure who was the legal man. And the Nasties won to a sizable pop from the crowd. Bobby Heenan, as the heel commentator perhaps shouldn't do, quite correctly questioned who was the legal man. But a very nice finish to Colin, what I would say was Nasty Boys babyface match go wasn't all that bad.
Yeah, as far as Nasty Boys matches go, wasn't bad. A babyface Nasty Boys is a little bit odd to me. But the fans seem into it, so
to a degree, they weren't that into it.
They seemed into it enough. I mean, I wouldn't have expected it to be as over as it was at that point. It was like, there were nasty chants, which I wasn't expecting. So I think if WCW book it right, then maybe it could gain a little bit of momentum. It was an okay match for the Nasty Boys, which I don't say very often. So it's the best you can hope for, really.
Chris?
Yeah, great tag team opener. Both teams did some really good tag team moves. The Nasties, as good guys as Colin was just saying, bit left field, but it was working. It's one of those I'd like to see where they're going to go with it and what else they're going to do with them. Because for a team that have always been heels, and, you know, with the name Nasty, you know, it's quite different to see them not cheating and using a bike helmet or something or a boot to win all their matches.
Yeah, I mean, we'll come to it in the TV review, but they are going to be involved in the main event at Full Brawl in the babyface quartet of the Nasty Boys and Dustin and Dusty Rhodes versus the Stud Stable. So I think we'll get perhaps a better indicator of, one, where they are at with the crowd, and secondly, you know, kind of how well they're going to work as babyfaces when we get to that next month. But no, I thought the match was fine. It wasn't necessarily anything much to write home about, but as an opener in a TV show, I thought it was okay. And, you know, the crowd could have been less into it, so I think that's certainly that. After the break, we come back and Mean Gene Oakland attempts to interview Hulk Hogan. Hogan comes out, he's American-made music plays, and he comes and tries to whip up the crowd. But as he gets out on the ramp, a masked assassin runs out from behind him and hits him in the back of the knee with a lead pipe, or what it appeared to be a lead pipe. Hogan writhes around in pain on the floor, and people like Eric Bischoff, Jimmy Hart, Nick Bockwinkel, and a variety of WCW officials stood around him. Mean Gene Oakland, who described this as if it was the most heinous crime he'd ever witnessed, said, "This is the most horrific thing I've ever seen." A stretch came out at this point, and he said, "This is absolute madness, total bedlam, a zoo-like atmosphere, a sham." Tony Schiavone, meanwhile, wasn't all that bothered. The crowd eventually started a brief Hogan chant, and Bobby Heenan says they have, quote, locked the arena to try and keep inside who did it. Colin, what do you think of this angle?
Mean Gene called it one of the most heinous crimes he'd ever seen, not letting everybody know about the prices of his hotlines. But
Burn, there we go.
Burn. it was a way of keeping the TV audience engaged with the entire show. And to that point, I think it worked. I think it might have got a little bit overdone towards the end of the show, but the purpose it served helped them in the end, because we all saw what the TV ratings were.
Chris?
Just as Colin was saying, pretty much it meant that we had a story arc for the show. It wasn't just match. It gave us something to keep coming back to. So, and as Colin was saying, it put eyes on it and people were watching it, so they clearly did something right.
Yeah, I mean, to say Mean Gene Oakland overdid it, I think would be an understatement. As I say, he was reacting like, you know, he'd just seen someone shot. I thought the antithesis between him and then Tony Schiavone, who just, you know, kind of treated it as if it was like a regulation occurrence, I thought was quite funny. We will come back to kind of that ongoing storyline as we get to it. Anyway, next match on the show, Ricky Steamboat versus Steve Austin for the US title. Before the match even starts, we cut to a backstage clip of Hulk Hogan being loaded into the ambulance. Bobby Heenan asks if there's even a hospital in Cedar Rapids, which I thought was quite funny. Austin is wearing trunks which read Dragon Slayer on the back. We got some chain wrestling to start, but that quickly breaks down as Austin and Steamboat exchange slaps. Austin prays off in the corner. An official talks to Bobby Heenan, who says that Hogan was struck with a pipe, and the official doubted whether Hogan would ever be able to wrestle again, which Heenan perhaps quite rightly laughed off. We then get a picture-in-picture shot of the camera following the ambulance. I will note, for what I'm about to set up in a few minutes' time, it is daylight outside. We get some nice smooth pin exchanges with counters, Steamboat working over Austin's left arm and shoulder during the match. Heenan sold the idea of Steamboat trying to get Austin to disqualify himself. The rules of the match said that if Austin were to be disqualified, the title would change hands. Steamboat goes for a standing sleeper hold, but Austin sits out on the move for a nice jawbreaker. Sting, apparently seeing what has happened, is flying into Cedar Rapids. He wasn't there. But he wasn't there at the start of the show, which was weird, although I guess he wasn't necessarily booked on the show. But he is, in storyline at least, now on a plane from Chicago to Cedar Rapids to prepare to fill in the main event should Hulk Hogan not make it. Back to the match, Steamboat goes for an old-school type Undertaker move, but rather than jump into the ring, he jumps to the outside and Austin's arm bounces off the rope, which is a very nice move. Austin then later on drops a knee from the top rope for a two count. Steamboat crotches Austin on the top rope, but goes for a superplex, but Austin drops him to the canvas. Austin, as he has done all match, disrespectfully slaps and taunts Steamboat, who has had enough and fights back. Steamboat hits a spine buster, then an electric chair drop. Austin kicks out both times. He then goes for a quartet of pins in various positions, but cannot get the job done. He then finally goes for a roll up, gets the three count, and we have a new US champion. Corin, we'll come to the Hogan stuff that went on during this match, in a minute, but what do you think of the match itself?
It was a very good match. Technically sound by two very good wrestlers. The only thing is I question whether Ricky Steamboat really needs the US title. I think Steve Austin, he's a fantastic wrestler, but I fear that he has the ability to get lost in the WCW mid-card without the title, whereas Ricky Steamboat is always going to be Ricky Steamboat. He doesn't need a belt. So I feel a little bit sorry for Austin having to drop the belt to him.
Chris?
I loved this match. Again, like last month with the Bash match. Great back and forth, sort of chain wrestling between the two of them. I loved how the match was playing out of the story with Austin trying not to get DQ'd. Because he was going to go to the well of the sort of things that he does, like throwing him over the ropes. Or, you know, slight cheating moves and catching himself just before he did it because he knew he couldn't get DQ'd because he'd lose the belt. I loved that. The only thing that did annoy me with it was the constant cutting in for the Hogan stuff during this match because this match was awesome.
Yeah, I mean, I think there was only one other match that, unless I'm forgetting something, that really suffered from the Hogan stuff, and that was the Regal Inoki match later on. But this was the one that really suffered in part because the Regal Inoki match was an absolute snoozer. But I thought that it was a necessary evil in the sense that yes, it did take away from what was actually a very good match. I think this is they've had a few matches this year, and I think this is probably the best one. And Chris, I think, as you say, the kind of Austin not being able to get DQ'd kind of perks your interest in the sense that, okay, how's he going to win this then? Or, as it turned out, he didn't. But once you rule out the opportunity for a DQ finish, I mean, I guess you could always book some other schmoz, and God knows WCW have done that enough. But it was set up for some kind of positive finish, one way or the other. And again, I thought the kind of the old school move dropping to the outside was really nice. There are a couple of other really nice exchanges in amongst all that as well. This probably was the best match of the show, I think. I don't think there's any real argument against that. But yeah, and obviously all the stuff going on outside of it. Colin, I'll come to you. I mean, I don't think there's an argument to say it took away from the match. It certainly did, but was it a necessary evil?
No. I just think Steve Austin and Ricky Steamboat deserved all of the attention on themselves. It was a great match. It didn't need anything else.
Fair enough. Fair enough. No, I disagree. I think it was, it did take away from it a bit, but as we see with the ratings, and I think as the, maybe the fault was putting this match in this position. Maybe you, I think you needed a lot of immediate feedback to keep people hooked in the immediate aftermath of the angle. So maybe the fault was having this match on second rather than maybe third. They had a lot of time, on this show. It was a longer clash than usual. I think it was 2.5 hours with commercial breaks, about 2 hours without. So it was a bit longer, this one, than the usual clash. But yeah, I think it was necessary, but I think you could certainly make the argument, put this match in a different spot. Anyway, well, after the break, we cut to a video of Hogan, being taken into the hospital. And the reason I noted it was daylight outside during the match, it was dark during this segment. That's right. It took them 10 minutes. And they must have travelled about 400 miles because it couldn't have been dark anywhere else. So there was a continuity error there. And the reason I raised this more the point was that we're going to have a segment in about 15 minutes time where it is dusk. So they film these segments out of sequence, it would seem. But the video was Bischoff outside the hospital with Hogan inside. Bischoff said that Hogan's quote said, "I felt something snap on the inside of my knee." Then we got an amazing Honky Tonk Man promo. Colin, this was great.
Oh, it was awful. Absolutely awful.
I say promo. It was a music video.
Yeah, which it's, and the music video sounded scarily familiar to his actual ring music from WWF as well.
Well, a bit like American Made. It's just a rip, isn't it? I would think.
Yeah, pretty much.
Chris, your thoughts on this Honky Tonk thing?
It wasn't as great as his performance at WrestleMania 6 with Honka 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 Love, which, you know, that was true musical genius. As you said, it's pretty much a clone of his WWF theme. But, you know, it shows you who Honky Tonk is. He's not going to change his gimmick, so...
You get what you get.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah, he's not going to be up more over in any other guys, so if you're going to employ him, this is what you're going to get. Then we have, after the break, we have Mean Gene Okerlund interviewing Commissioner Nick Bockwinkle. Bockwinkle says that he has no update on Hogan, but says that if Hogan cannot make it, he will have to forfeit the title to Flair. They get a video recap of Dustin in the ring with Dusty. Dusty says that he's neglected him. He calls Buck and Parker, quote-unquote, chicken feed. Terry Funk, a, quote, low-life watermelon beef egg-sucking dog. He says to hell with Arn Anderson and asks Dustin if he can be his partner in the tag match tonight. He asks for a hug and a kiss, and he gets it, and the crowd pop. Back into the main ring, also that was a video package, or video highlights from a previous show. Tony Funk and Bunkhouse Buck versus Dustin and Dusty Rhodes. The Rhodes is clear house early on. Terry Funk, I've got in my notes, quote, goes Terry Funk on the outside. A bit mad, but that is Terry Funk. Dustin is then double-teamed early on, but easily overcomes the numbers game before tagging his dad, who is all kinds of over with the crowd. He hits the atomic elbow on Bunkhouse Buck. Buck shoots Dustin into the corner, but Dustin blocks the corner to stop him sustaining any damage. Dustin goes to tag his dad, but the referee doesn't see it, so Buck's able to keep the advantage. Buck goes for a double axe handle off the top rope, but Dustin moves and he catches Funk instead. Arn Anderson comes out. The faces come on top, but Arn Anderson jumps into the ring and forces a DQ. After the match, Dustin faces off against Arn Anderson and hits the Bionic Elbow, then faces off against Meng, goes to the outside, grabs a chair, comes back into the ring, smashes Meng over the head in the chair, who proceeds to no-sell it. Meng then punches Dusty, puts in a nerve hold on his shoulder. WCW officials and jobbers come out, but Meng and the Stud Stable see them off. Chris, this match wasn't all that, but I thought the closing segment was excellent.
Yeah, the match itself was a good brawling match, you know. It was nice to see the Dusty back in the ring and doing what he does, you know, hitting elbows. But that chair shot, just the fact that it cracked over his head and he's just there wearing it as a necklace.
Yeah, it was a wooden chair, to be clear. Yeah, it was a wooden chair, to be clear, so it kind of disintegrated as it got dropped over his head.
The sunglasses slightly moved, and he just sort of looks at him and is like, "What's that all about?"
What are you doing? Yeah.
Ming looks like a monster.
Colin, I thought Meng looked great.
Yeah, everybody might know him better as Haku from WWF, but the way that he no-sold the chair shot was just perfect. I mean, not even a flinch. I mean, this wooden chair just disintegrated around his head.
And Dusty hit him. It was a wooden folding chair, and maybe it was a doctored wooden folding chair. We probably haven't considered that. But Dusty hit him, and he
put some welly behind it.
And the seat kind of like snapped over his head, but the rest of it stayed together. So as Chris said, it ended up just being wrapped around his head, and he didn't sell it at all.
Like a wooden chair necklace.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, the fact that he did not flinch, it was perfect. He couldn't have no-sold it any better.
No. And then I thought this was a very effective angle in getting over the stud stable as heels. Obviously, after that, Meng locks in a nerve hold on Dusty's shoulder. And
which Dusty squealed like a pig for.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. He knows when he needs to, you know, show some ass, he'll show some ass. And he certainly did that there. It was a very effective segment, and I think a very nice setup to their full brawl match next month with Wilson and the Nasty Boys in their corner. We cut back to Eric Bischoff at the hospital. It is dusk. So yes, we've gone forward in time now. Bischoff is with Henry Holmes, who's Hulk Hogan's real life attorney. Holmes said that Hogan is in X-ray and is in a great deal of pain. He said that Hogan has been advised to decline to wrestle and concede the title, but says that Hogan isn't listening and wants to wrestle. Mysteriously, it's lighter outside. We then cut back to the arena. Mean Gene Okerlund is interviewing Ric Flair. Flair says if Hogan can hear him, he wants him to walk down the aisle and hand in the title and say, Ric Flair, you are right. You are the greatest of all time. Sherry says she has come to dance passionately on Hulk Hogan's grave. We then have Hulk Hogan. The news is that Hulk Hogan is on his way back to the arena, which the crowd pops big for. Bobby Heenan questions whether he will wrestle or whether he's simply going to adhere to Flair's request and hand in the title. Then we get to Lord Steven Regal versus Antonio Inoki. This was the match, obviously, they set up last month. Inoki comes out and he's moving very well, actually. He moves probably better than his age would, or his, how he looks would suggest. Regal takes the opportunity to attack him before he can get in the ring. This match wasn't all that good. I didn't have a ton of notes on it. I got an uncoordinated brawl, largely focused on striking and close wrestling. We get a shot of Hulk Hogan on his way back to the arena, visibly limping. Nick Bockwinkel comes out and he says to Bobby Heenan, we have advised him not to wrestle, as does everyone else. Word is he will wrestle, but WCW cannot be responsible for what happens. From largely out of nowhere, Inoki puts a sleeper hold on Regal, and Regal passes out. Chris, if there was a down on this show, this was it.
Yeah, it was very much a 70s, 80s World of Sports style match where it was lots of open hand strikes, grapples. The only good bit that I remember of the match was Regal hitting a really nice butterfly suplex. It served its purpose. It you know, gave Inoki the win after being disrespected at the Bash. But I could do with not seeing it again.
Colin?
I mean, Antonio Inoki is a legend in Japan, in wrestling in general. So it's nice for WCW to have a man with his stature on the card. And then you think if you put him in with Steven Regal, you could get a decent match out of it. But unfortunately, it didn't really work. It's like Chris said, it was very World of Sport orientated type match, Japanese style, which I don't really think it just doesn't work for the American fans at the moment. So it didn't come over very well. You had Bobby Heenan screaming every time Inoki put on his, which was a choke hold, which apparently Schiavone was telling us all that it was legal in Japan. Well, we're not in Japan, so okay.
Got to cover your track somehow, I suppose.
Exactly. It's a nice to have Inoki on the card, but it really wasn't good.
No, I mean, I may have indirectly or kind of muted the idea that WCW is owed credit last month for putting on a snoozer of a tag match for the main event. I don't know whether I can give them credit for going 2 for 2, because this didn't seem to be a snoozer by design. I mean, I don't think either of you watched, I think it was Spring Stampede when Muta was facing Steve Austin, but I do wonder whether Japanese babyfaces in America are going to struggle to get crowd reactions when their facial expressions are so limited.
I did see Spring Stampede. I did watch the Muta and Steve Austin match, and I think it was a lot better match than Regal and Inoki was.
Oh, it was, but I thought Muta struggled in that match to get over with the crowd against the heel, yeah, Austin, because of his lack of facial expressions. I think a similar thing would have happened here.
You had Muta behind the paint, and I don't think the American wrestling fans can get behind a Japanese guy against, say, in Steve Austin's case, against the US, but I mean,
Regal's
British.
Yeah.
So you've got basically two wrestlers that the fans maybe aren't overly interested in wrestling each other, and that's what we got. The fan reaction was great to it.
And then, Chris, the perhaps bizarre decision of having the guest, Antonio Inoki, choking out the full-time WCW wrestler, Stephen Regal. That seemed bizarre.
Yeah, the only thing I could see of doing it is because obviously Inoki is a legend, and it's his last run, and he's not going to be seen again, so let him go out on a win. I don't really think it hurts Regal that much. Regal still can come back from this. He'll just find someone else who they give a plaque to or an award to. Go back to that sort of thing of, how dare you give it to him? You should give it to me. I'm a well-deserving English gentleman. And go from there.
Yeah. And then, on to the main event. We do get Hulk Hogan versus Ric Flair. Flair comes out, he goads Hogan and demands him to bring back the title. Hogan's music plays, but there is no Hogan. Flair continues to run his mouth, and eventually Hogan comes out with a strapped up knee, accompanied by Jimmy Hart and Brutus the Barber Beefcake. The match begins with Hogan beating down on Flair. Flair chops him in the corner, but Hogan hulks up and rips off his shirt. Hogan even bites Flair's forehead. Match spills to the outside, Hogan totally on top. Hogan drops him off the top rope to the canvas. There were a ton of back/chest breaks by Hogan during this match with the action on the outside. The crowd were, not surprisingly, super into all of it. Hogan goes to swing a chair at one point, but Flair gets out of the way and regains control back in the ring. Hogan then uses a crutch from the woman in the crowd. Flair finally starts to attack Hogan's injured knee. This is, 10 minutes into the match. The ref was dealing with... The ref was Miss Sherry crotching Hulk Hogan, dealing with Jimmy Hart. Sorry, I read Hart in my notes and then tried to work out where I went wrong. Flair continues the damage on the injured knee. Flair goes for the figure four. Hogan rises in pain, but eventually powers out. Flair goes straight back to work, but Hogan manages to get the big boot and drops the leg, but cannot get the immediate covering. Flair manages to get back up, locking the figure four again. Hogan at one point appears to tell the referee to end it, but didn't. And then manages to flip the move over so they are both now facing downwards. Hogan kind of tries to get out the move by crawling out of the ring, but as he starts to kind of hang out on the outside, Sherry attacks him with her shoe, not for a DQ. And then the referee counts Hogan out, who was kind of hanging on the apron with his body outside of the ropes, but not out of the ring, and completely overlooking the fact that they were out on the outside earlier in the match, and there was no count out. Colin, the crowd were into this. I thought it told a decent story, though, with some extraordinary logic holes.
Yeah, the crowd was super into it. I would go as far as say that it's what you would call now a standard Flair match. I do not understand the logic behind taking 10 minutes to start working over the knee, especially as Flair's finisher is the figure four. Surely it'd be the very first thing Flair attacks, even if it's just a stomp to the knee right at the start.
I mean,
of the match.
It's not like Flair had a ton of offense in that opening 5-10 minutes, but he had bits, and you'd think, if you're Flair, that's the first thing I aim for.
Yeah, absolutely. You saw Hogan biting, raking the back. It's, you know, it's a bit un-Hogan-esque, but he was doing the whole back against the wall thing. He's got the bad leg, so he had to do what he can to try and scrape a victory. But when you get to the finish, it's a ridiculous finish. Absolutely ridiculous.
Was it even a count out?
Why was it a count out? Surely with Hogan underneath the ropes, the move should be broken. That's it. There's no count out.
And then why wasn't Flair disqualified for Sherry hitting Hogan with her shoe?
It's a silly finish. Really silly finish.
Chris?
Was this a no DQ match?
No.
Because...
Not that I'm aware of.
How did Hogan not get DQ'd right at the beginning with the choking him with the bandana and the sign that he got from the crowd? And the biting, because...
And the crutch from the lady.
And yeah. he went with a chair at one point.
It's the thing.
Maybe it was DQ, maybe they didn't tell us. Maybe it was an ODQ match.
Because there's so many times here that if they wanted to, you know, have Flair win but not take the title, could have quite easily DQ'd Hogan a lot of times instead of having a quite lame-looking count-out. As Colin was saying, I was a bit surprised it took Flair 10 minutes to start working on the leg. You'd have thought that straight away, a couple of chop blocks and some knee smashes would have been the way that Flair would have gone for it. It was a good match, but you know the logic holes did bring it down a bit.
Colin, did Hogan give up in this match?
Well, it looked like he told the ref, yes, that's it. And as the referee went to point to the bell for it to be rung, Hogan stopped him and said, no, I've changed my mind. So technically, yeah, he did give up, but then changed his mind. So, it's all right, we'll just carry on.
Is that how it works, is it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Right, okay. All right, so anyway, after the match, Flair claims that he is champion, because obviously he did win the match. Referee denies this, or was it a DQ? I've got in my notes, nobody's sure, and nobody really is sure. Hogan comes around and attacks Flair. The masked man then runs out, and apparently it was so obvious that it was Arn Anderson that people were chanting his name. Ran out and attacked Hogan's knee again. Flair climbs to the top and drops his knee, then locks in the figure four, and the masked man runs off. Sting runs out, clearly his flight was far too late, runs off Flair and Sherry. Flair leaves with the title belt in hand, but not as champion. Hogan is left in pain, being checked on by Sting to end the show. Chris, what were your overall thoughts on the show and a score rating?
It was a really, really good, solid TV show. Other than the Inoki Regal match, the matches were good. There was the overgrowing story arc. It was a step down from Bash, but then Bash was a pay-per-view, and I think Bash of the Beach is one of the best WCW pay-per-views in a long while. Overall, I've given it a 7 out of 10, because other than that Inoki Regal match, it was a great show.
Colin?
Yeah, I've had the pleasure of watching some of the worst WCW shows you can think of. This is by far one of the better ones. That's again, apart from the Inoki Regal match, pretty solid show. I had it down as a 7 as well.
We have a unanimous agreement. I'm also giving it 7 out of 10. The Inoki Regal match was what it was, but not that I really bring in TV ratings to kind of review a show, but when you look at the ratings, you have to say that the Hogan Flair thing was definitely worth it running throughout the show, and it was a nice story arc. It was something that got Hogan involved in the show early on, and kept people interested based on what we saw from there. The Steamboat Austin match was very good. The Funkhouse Buck Rhodes match was okay, but the post-match angle I thought was excellent. If the main event had have had fewer logic holes, because there are ways you can do that type of finish without breaking so many kind of wrestling rules and wrestling logic in before it. But I thought it was a good main event and a very enjoyable show on the whole. Moving on to the WCW television review. On August the 6th, we had another live show inviting the fans to vote for another face versus heel match. Apparently, they do have live shows planned once a month from now on in, although I think they are in Europe next month, so that might be starting in October. Actually, Duggan, I believe, made his in-ring debut on the 6th of episode as well. He won a squash match. Ric Flair faced Terry Taylor. Terry interfered at the end with a very good top rope crossbody to the outside. Hogan interrupted via the video wall. In the main event, Dustin Rhodes defeated Bunkhouse Buck, and there was a massive poach match brawl. On the August the 13th edition, Bobby Heenan arrived in a neck brace and claimed that Hogan was choked him out, caused it. That is a legit neck injury. Heenan had that neck brace on throughout the tapings, and that is nothing to do with storyline. They didn't kind of go with that any further. That was just Heenan being Heenan. On the August the 20th edition, we saw the beginning of the breakup of Cactus Jack and Kellyman Sullivan as a tag team. Sullivan was distracted by his brother Dave on the outside needing help, and distraction cost his team the match. And the promo of the following week saw Cactus DDT Dave Sullivan, and that's his heel turn. An intensive element before the Clash of Champions as the main event descended into a brawl involving Dustin and Dusty, along with a troop of WCW faces fighting off the stud stable of Colonel Robert Parker, Meng, Arn Anderson, Bunkhouse Buck, and Terry Funk. On the August the 27th edition of WCW Saturday Night, Nick Bockwinkle suspended Ric Flair and Sherry Martel indefinitely in the continental United States, so Flair can tour Europe, following their interference in the main event of the Clash of Champions, along with Flair seen to be behind the attack that caused Hogan. Dustin Rhodes went into the, quote, nasty part of town to find the now baby-faced nasty boys in a bar, and he talked them into joining him and his son in the War Games main event at Full Brawl. And that will wrap up this month's show, so we will go to our moments, or moment of the month. Colin, you first.
Moment of the month. I think my favourite moment of the month is Brett superplex to Owen. It's just picture perfect. You could watch it over and over again. They could not have done that move any better. It was, and from the height as well, brilliant.
Was that your match of the month? Because it is kind of match slash moment either or.
Yeah, yeah. I can't see a match better than that this month.
Chris,
I have to go with Colin. I heard Brett Owen. That is. So far, it's up there with the ladder match with Razor and Sean of match of the year. When it comes to the end of the year, something's going to have to be special to beat either of those to be my match of the year.
Well, I would agree with you, but it's not all that controversial. The segment I'm going for match of the month, us three haven't discussed because it was in earlier in the show in the ECW segment. My segment of the month, without question, was the Sandman and Tommy Dreamer. The stuff with Singapore Kane was fantastic. Really good. It was a very powerful segment and did a lot for Tommy Dreamer, I think, in terms of, you know, a lot of people saying, you know, he's the pretty boy and all that kind of thing, and all of that. So that was my segment of the month. And that will end this month's show, so I'd like to thank Colin Judkins.
Thank you very much.
You are on Twitter.
At Colin Judkins.
And Chris Lacey.
Cheers very much, Bob.
You're on Twitter, and I believe you've got a podcast, plug away, and all of the above.
My Twitter is Lacey555666. We have the Bottom Line podcast, which episode 3, which is our SummerSlam review, should be up by now. And
that's 2014 SummerSlam, to be clear.
Yes, doing monthly pay-per-view reviews.
And you can follow the Wrestling 20 Years account at Wrestling 20 YRS. You can follow me at Bobby Bamber, although as people have seen on Twitter, I'm kind of watching less current day wrestling now, for what that's worth. We are on Wrestling20Years.com. You can find us on iTunes. You can leave us a rating and a review there. That'd be very much appreciated. RSS feed on the website as well. So if you listen via like some podcatcher or something like that, you can get us there. And that'll be it. We'll be back in a month's time with the September show. So until next time, I'll be Bob Bamber. This has been the August 1994 edition of the Wrestling 20 Years Ago podcast. Until next time, goodbye.